The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Susan Dellinger from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine, February 2018, Volume 19, Number 2. And this is the first of four installments of the February issue. This month, we have three covers, with three dramatic and dramatically different Oprahs. On the first cover, Oprah channels Diana Ross. Her naturally curly, massive mane is swept back and to one side as if by the wind. Against a gold velvet background, Oprah wears a shimmery gold crushed pan velvet long dress with a deeply scooped neckline and three-quarter length sleeves. Heavy gold silk threads smock the top of the skirt at its ampere waistline, just below the bust line. The big white O for Oprah Magazine sits on a deep gold background. This month's headline is, What Defines You? It's not your hair, your job, or even the way you vote. Get ready to embrace the essential you. And when we turn the cover, we have our second cover, in which Oprah is wearing an off-the-shoulder, figure-hugging, navy sweater dress with long trumpet sleeves that have three layers of ruffles. Her hair is pulled back tight against her head, parted in the middle, and it has this massive ponytail in large curls that come midway her back. And it's got brilliant colors. It's an ombre effect of magenta, purple, and pink. And she's wearing big gold hoop earrings. And on the third cover, we have Oprah looking out at us in a bob that looks a little bit like her best friend Gail. So she has fringe or bangs, and it's just barely touches the top of her shoulders, and it's a little bit spiky, and she's wearing a white sweater dress with a deep V-neck and small ribbing and some slits cut out seductively at the shoulder. Now let's check out behind the scenes. Best dressed. Oprah is a woman of many moods and hairdos. For each of this month's three covers, stylist Nicole Mangrum created a transformative look using wigs and hair pieces. Oprah unleashed her inner Diana Ross with a curly mane, while a textured ponytail with a pink, magenta, and purple accents brought unexpected edge. I'm kind of liking it, Oprah said at the shoot. The fact that I'm now turning to pink means the world is changing. The trifecta was complete with a sassy shag that gave Oprah her fringe back, prompting our cover girl to quip, I haven't had bangs since 1992. Now, with a little more detail, the first one is curls on curls, and we see Oprah sitting having her hair worked on. Bring out curls with a 3/8-inch iron that can be used with or without the clamp. To get the look, apply curl cream to wet hair, then use a diffuser to dry and add body, says Mangrum. Create curls or accentuate existing ones by wrapping sections around a small 3/8-inch curling iron. Let the curls cool and set. To achieve 70s-style volume, brush out hair with a boar bristle paddle brush and add hairspray for hold. And the products they show here are Paul Mitchell Pro Tools Express Ion Curl Excess Curling Iron, $65, and go to paulmitchell.com for more details. And then it's a 10 Miracle Defrizzing Curl Cream, $24 at it's10haircare.com. Now to get this second look with the different colors in the ponytail. To get the look, while Mangrum used colored extensions on Oprah, you can attach a faux pony for an easier take or simply work with your natural hair. Part strands down the center and smooth into a low pony. Apply a dab of pomade or molding clay around the hairline to keep the edges down. Enhance just the tail by wrapping sections around a half-inch curling iron and add an ombre combo of temporary colors. And they show here, it's no holds barred when you use no commitment washout color. Paint it on dry hair and lock in the color with a blow dryer. And they show the three different colors here in the tubes. And then we have Living Proof Style Lab Molding Clay in a big black pot. And it's $26. Go to livingproof.com. And then Clairol Color Crave Hair Makeup is $11 at drugstores. So that's where you get the magenta and the pink and the purple. And now our third style, the choppy crop. To get the look, thinking of making the cut? Try wigs or clip-in bangs first to see what works, Mangrum says. To style, start by adding a bit of oil, then blow dry hair to a smooth and shiny finish. For a flippy effect, use a flat iron in alternate directions, keeping ends straight. Apply texturizing spray, then tussle hair. The T3 Single Pass X Flat Iron is $230 at t3micro.com. Oribe Dry Texturizing Spray is $46 at oribe.com. And then we have Pantene Gold Series Intense Hydrating Oil, $8 at drugstores. And beside that, we have the text, Lustrous Locks are always in style. Before you blow dry, use this moisturizing oil for high shine plus softness. And now, let's hear Oprah's opening comments. And here we go. In my life, I've been a grocery store clerk, a pageant queen, a radio newscaster, a talk show host, an advocate for girls, and a kale chip enthusiast. But I wouldn't say those things define me. What you do, or for that matter, how you talk or walk or dress, isn't who you are. And who you are today may not be who you are tomorrow, because people can learn and change and grow. This month, we're doing a deep dive into identity, spotlighting people who dare to find and be themselves, and challenging ourselves to see beyond your own preconceptions and snap judgments when dealing with others. For some fascinating perspective on all of it, I sat down with the wise and wonderful RuPaul. I think you'll be mesmerized by what he has to say. You know what else is mesmerizing? Sleep. But too many of us never get enough. If that sounds like you, head over to page 84, where you'll find our guide to all things shut-eye, why the right amount of it is literally a matter of life and death, and how you, yes, overscheduled, undersnoozed you, can get a much-needed ticket to slumberland. You deserve to be rested and ready for the most important part you'll ever play, the real you. Read on, Oprah. Let's go to one of the regular features in the magazine, and that is the reading room. And we will look at 10 titles to pick up now. So we have brief descriptions of 10 hot new titles. When They Call You a Terrorist by Patrice Kahn, Colors, and Asha Bendeli. What You Don't Condemn, You Condone, and So We Protest. That's the message of this fierce, intimate memoir by a co-founder of Black Lives Matter that sheds light on how a movement was born. The second title is The Art of Mystery by Maud Casey. The author of three novels, Casey here explores how fiction writers, from Kafka to Coetzee, make use of the unexpected and unknown to restore our capacity for wonder and even thaw, quote, the frozen seas of our souls, end of quote. The third title is This Could Hurt by Gillian Medoff. This big-hearted dramedy of manners stars Rosa, one of the most intriguing characters ever to walk the halls of an HR department, and her supporting cast of flawed but devoted employees who set aside their differences to rescue their leader for a change, the one who needs help. The fourth title is Need to Know by Karen Cleveland. The author, who drafted this story while on maternity leave from the CIA, centers her pulse-pounding debut novel, Think Homeland, by way of Gone Girl, on Vivian Miller, who's put it all on the line in her quest to uncover Russian sleeper cells on American soil. The fifth title is Deliverance Mary Fields by Miente Metcalf McConnell. An indefatigable former slave who braved the Montana Rockies on a journey to rescue a dying friend is the real-life subject of this 19th-century frontier narrative. Adventure abounds in this little-known tale of the heroic middle-aged woman who became the first female African-American mail carrier in the U.S. The sixth title is Off the Charts, The Hidden Lives and Lessons of American Child Prodigies by Anne Hulbert. Part ode to young genius, part indictment of helicopter parenting, Hulbert's crisply written account of uber-achieving kids probes our own complicated obsessions with talent and the need to stand out. The seventh title is Wild is the Wind, Poems by Carl Phillips. Elliptical moments and tender revelations give way to images of startling beauty in Phillips' mystical 14th collection. And here's an example. Across the field, birds fly like the storm-shook shadows of themselves and not like birds. The eighth title is The Wife by Alifair Burke. Written by a former prosecutor with a genius for plot, this thrill ride of a novel takes a hard look at loyalty and the violence a secret can cause, especially when that secret involves a revered public figure accused of rape. The ninth title is A State of Freedom by Neil Mukherjee. An edgy, absorbing novel exploring the scars of displacement through five disparate characters amid the din of modern India and the shadowlands that lurk beneath the surface of the everyday. And our final and tenth title is Red Clocks by Lenny Zumas. In Zumas's third book, a reproductive rights dystopia in the vein of Margaret Atwood and Octavia Butler, embryos are granted full humanity, and in response, five female Oregonians rage against the machine. Let's look now at the Live Your Best Life section of the magazine and the big photograph on the first page this month is of a young girl. She looks like she's maybe about 6 years old. She looks Hispanic, and she's standing on a bed that has this floral bedspread on it. She has a crown, a Toy Story crown, a pair of swim goggles, and a magenta curtain, a sheer curtain tied around her neck like a cape. She's got on these pink and white striped leggings and a leotard and other little fluffy, frilly ruffles that look like they're from a dance costume. And we have a quote from Ta-Nehisi Coates, which says, "My wish for you is that you feel no need to constrict yourself to make other people comfortable." And let's read the gratitude meter. Five things we're smiling about this month, from awe to awesome. And coming in at the first position, male bonding, M-A-I-L bonding. Some dogs snarl at delivery people, and some want to slobber all over them. The latter are celebrated on UPS Dogs, a Facebook page documenting the bond between UPS truck drivers and the pups they meet and occasionally treat on the road. Go to facebook.com/UPS Dogs. And we have a picture of a couple of blonde labs trying to get in a UPS truck. And the second item here is munch time. Your fire is roaring, your well-defined couch dent is calling, and there are 201 episodes of The Office waiting to be screened. Cap off the coziness with the gourmet Binge Watch Bundle from Philadelphia's DeBruno Brothers. It packs a smoky Gouda spread blended with a splash of beer, black lava sea salt cashews. Need we go on? And we have a picture of an assortment of these munchies, from popcorn to chocolate-covered pretzels to the Gouda. Go to dibruno.com to find out more. Okay, right in the middle of the pack, fit to be tied. Paper is getting cut. Nuno's eco-friendly gift wrap fabrics can be folded, tucked, and tied around packages big and small. And after your cousin unwraps the scented candle you got her, she can pay it forward by reusing the machine washable textile when it's her turn to give. NunoWrap.com, that's N-U-N-O. wrap.com. And they have these packages here. Both of these are square. One is a red and white zigzag pattern. And they don't need tape because the way you wrap them, you actually tie them at the top. Okay, we're getting closer to Totally Awesome. Our next item here is career moves. Bumblebiz, from the makers of dating app Bumble, is a new networking platform that allows women to connect with fellow professionals, even on the road. So if you're at a ho-hum conference in Wichita, you can swipe through Bumble Biz to find an impromptu dinner, yoga, or movie buddy. Excuse me, let me try that the third time. Movie buddy. And our last item at Totally Awesome is Community Collage. Lena Waithe's new Showtime series, The Chi, brings the actor, writer, and recent Emmy winner for comedy writing on Master of None back to her Chicago roots in what feels like a love letter to her hometown. And across the bottom of the page, it says, take note, win, win, win. Meet three first-time Winter Olympic hopefuls out to prove they're as good as gold. And the first one, Carrie Jones, 24, of Killeen, Texas, in bobsledding. There's a picture of her in her figure-hugging tight Olympic uniform, which is that deep royal, almost navy blue, with white stars across the shoulders and red stripes on the sleeves. Peak performance, won gold at the 2017 World Championship with teammate Alana Myers-Taylor. On busting myths, she says, there are quite a few misconceptions about bobsledding. First, we don't train in tubs. That's not a thing. And we don't lean into the back of the sled. People have just seen cool runnings too many times. And next is Karen Chen, 18, of Fremont, California, figure skating. Peak performance, current U.S. National Figure Skating Championship. And her words from the wise? She says, before the 2017 World Figure Skating Championships, my mentor, Christy Yamaguchi, told me this, skate dumb. I thought she was being funny, but she's right. By competition time, it's too late to think on the ice. You need to let your body move like you've trained it to do. And finally, we have Chloe Kim, 17, of La Palma, California. Her sport is snowboarding. Peak performance, first female to land back-to-back 1080s in a U.S. Grand Prix competition. And her advice on the common cold. She says, I'm freezing the entire time I'm on the slopes. I try to keep moving to stay warm, but that's hard to do when it's minus 10 degrees. I've heard it helps to visualize standing in the desert, but I tried that, and it just made me feel colder. We'll move now to that special part of the magazine where we have the special topics for the month. and for February 2018. And this is the part where I always look forward to looking how the creative folks at O are going to, at O Magazine, are going to give us the Oprah O. And this month we have a close-up of an owl's head and its eyes looking straight at us. And the eye has the big Oprah O in it in orange and yellow. Most owls are nocturnal, but if you don't enjoy being up at night, you're not alone. Feast your tired eyes on our comprehensive guide to sleep. Wondering why slumber is so elusive? We've got the answers. Who are you? Is the next question. This month, we're exploring how we define ourselves and those around us. You may never see that woman in the mirror the same way again. And finally, our Valentine's Day treats make sweet gifts because dessert is always a hoot. So now let's dig into some of these special topics this month. And we'll start out with what defines you? And the graphics associated with this, on one page, we have a puzzle. So we have the headline, What Defines You, printed on here. We have kind of a dusty red background. And then we have a white silhouette of a woman. So a puzzle has been stamped into that. Then they've taken those puzzle pieces apart. They've stacked them on top of each other on the next page and used them to form a question mark. Is it your job? Your hometown? Your love of 70s soft rock? We'd like to suggest that it's something more elemental, a force that guides your decisions, shapes your perceptions, and roots you in your truth. If you're ready to set aside your assumptions and open your mind to who you might really be, turn the page. Each of us walks the earth wearing invisible labels on our chests. If we're lucky, the ones bestowed upon us feel comfortably correct, and we never chafe against their limitations. If we're not, we may spend years of agony and countless hard-earned dollars trying to escape the way we're classified to outrun what the world thinks it knows. Of course, not all those labels are applied to us by outside forces. We are hardwired to categorize ourselves, too. It's an oddly satisfying process. Even if you're the one to blame for a particular hair shirt, at least it's something you stitched yourself. But what if we could shed our ill-fitting identities and embrace the idea of uncertainty? Because as much as you think you've got yourself or anyone around you pegged, what you know yourself to be is only a fraction of the full you. Being born poor or loud or with a nose that could be optimistically described as having character doesn't determine your existence. Just as a thick layer of clouds today doesn't necessarily prohibit you from sunbathing tomorrow. As Walt Whitman well knew, we contain multitudes, and it's your prerogative, maybe even your duty, to take a look behind the classifications you've given yourself and others and examine them with an unblinking eye. In this O's year of big questions, we want to ask, what defines you? And our first contribution is called Here Comes the Judge. Sociologist Janice Prince, PhD, writes a prescription for seeing the world more clearly. You spot a woman buying shampoo in CVS, and within seconds, you've mentally clocked her income level, social standing, and jean size, all without exchanging so much as an excuse me. Sound familiar? Snap judgments are a biological necessity handed down from our ancestors. Often a glance was the only thing they had to go on when sizing up their surroundings and calculating risk. But in a world as codified and gendered as our modern one, it's a little odd to be lugging around a suitcase full of biases that shape and warp our perception. You spot someone who looks threatening and immediately cross the street. A seemingly innocent maneuver, sure, except there can be high psychic costs and real-world consequences when we make certain judgments about strangers. Changing one's approach isn't a cakewalk. It's easier not to interrogate every experience, and who doesn't want easy? But we can talk ourselves into at least being occasionally conscious of the flawed or problematic ideas our unconscious might be hinting at. As an experiment, next time you find yourself rushing to judgment, try asking yourself these questions. And we have five of them. What other explanations are there for this situation? That would be the first question. The next question, how might I feel if I were the other party in this situation? The third question, how might the other party describe the situation if they were recounting it? And the fourth question, how might I see this if I were male or female? And then finally, how might I see this if my skin were a different shade? Our next contribution is called Ask Me Anything. Priya Jain learns that the toughest questions come from the mouths of familiar babes. One afternoon, my 3-year-old asks if we are black. Actually, we're brown, I tell him, keeping my voice neutral. What's that? He asks. What's what? I reply, stalling. He narrows his eyes at me. Mommy, what are you? It's the question I hate most, and here it is being spoken by my toddler. What I am is American, born in Canada, raised in Atlanta, naturalized at 14, and I signal American, too, from my Gap jeans to the upspeak that makes me sound more Valley Girl than Indus Valley. And yet, for 39 years, strangers have asked where I am from. And when the answer fails to satisfy, as will my answer to their inevitable follow-up, but where were you born? This uglier question pops out. What are you? It's the silent question animating the stranger who smells of lipstick in line at the bank, asking how I learned such good English. The one that the dentist, his fingers in my mouth, thinks he's answered when he tells me, unprompted, that he really enjoyed the namesake. I do not want my son to inherit my history of anger and hurt, of trying to define myself against those who cannot see me as American. Especially now, when our very government cannot see it. What do I tell my boy, who will form his identity in this America? For now, I can give him only the facts. Nanny and Nana, his grandparents, are Indian, I tell him. That makes me Indian, too, and it makes you half Indian. Indian, he whispers, and I see the gears turn to open up a space in his brain for this new word. It is a marvel to hear him say it, for in his mouth it does not signify the things it did when I was young. Foreigner, other, unwelcome. I send up a wish that it will never mean those things for him, though I know I can't protect him completely. All I can do is give him a home where, in his half-brown, all-Americanness, he belongs. And when we move on, we have Address Yourself. As the lead singer of the band Against Me, Laura Jane Grace is accustomed to the spotlight, but she uses her impressive vocals more than punk rock choruses. Since she started her gender transition in 2012, an experience she recounted in her 2016 memoir, Tranny, Grace has become a vibrant spokesperson for LGBT causes. In 2012, she released a 10-episode web series called True Trans, in which she traveled the country gathering the stories of other members of the trans community and dispelling myths. She also sits on the board of If You Want It, a nonprofit that supports a more expansive understanding of gender. One vital step toward that goal is reframing our everyday speech. For Grace, even tiny words like he or she are a matter of respect. And next, we're required to claim our gender countless times a week, whether deciding which public restroom to use or checking Mr. or Mrs. when ordering flowers online. And though you might never have had to think twice about your pronouns, for a trans person like me, they can be tricky. On one hand, that little part of speech isn't the only thing that defines me. I know who I am, and I'm not devastated every time I'm incorrectly called he. But using someone's preferred pronouns, mine are she and her, is an immediate indicator of courtesy and respect. When it comes to being misgendered, I take things on a case-by-case basis. Recently, an old friend accidentally called me he, and yes, it bummed me out, but it didn't end our friendship. It was a simple mistake. I don't need to be treated with kid gloves. In general, transitioning has taught me greater empathy and acceptance. I'm really appreciative of anyone who asks how I'd like to be identified. Of course, it's best not to shout, "Hey, what are your pronouns?" across a dinner table, but discreetly pulling someone aside to ask, "How would you like to be referred to?" is easy to do. When you're unsure about someone else, try reverting to gender-neutral options like they, them, their. If that requires an expanded way of thinking and communicating, then so be it. Speech changes over time. Things that would have been linguistically proper 200 years ago would sound absurd now. Language has evolved, and so should we. And our next contribution is called Attitude Adjustment. Author Sarah Knight helps spruce up your headspace. You're always so blank, silly, aggressive, angry, etc. Someone cracks offhandedly, and the word ricochets inside your head for weeks as a criticism that makes you feel bad about yourself. But what if you could tweak those critical classifications and, in the process, your self-image? Our brains can change in response to our thoughts through a process called neuroplasticity, which researchers have even used to help treat patients with obsessive-compulsive disorder. I'm no neuroscientist, but I have my own method called mental redecorating, a simple way to refresh how I interpret day-to-day life. Just as you might move armchairs away from the TV and around a coffee table to create a more inviting atmosphere, you can make your brain a more inviting, benevolent place. All it takes is a change in perspective. So we have pairs of words here. Picky, with an arrow pointing to discerning. If friends accuse you of being picky when you reject their lunch spot suggestions, that's not necessarily a bad thing, especially if you're saving them from being squished into two small booths and a too loud dining room. You're discerning, and that's good for everyone. Our next word pair, stubborn, with an arrow to steadfast. Like a cast iron garden gnome, you're hard to move, stubborn, and maybe a little annoying to mow around. But you also won't blow away in a storm. When the going gets tough, your friends and family are lucky to have someone as steadfast as you on their lawn, or in their corner. Our next word pair, selfish to self-aware. People say you're selfish because you don't volunteer for as many school activities as other moms, but that allows you to spend more time with your family instead of on planning committees. You're not selfish. You know what you need to be the best for you, and that's better for everyone. Here's our next word pair, pushy, with an arrow pointing to passionate. Taking the helm of the charity bake sale, yet again, makes you feel pushy. But you did go to culinary school and dream of opening your own business. You're legitimately passionate about selling red velvet cake, and that's pretty sweet. And here's our final word pair, brash, with an arrow pointing to confident. Like a cherry red rug in an all-white room, you announce your presence in no uncertain terms. Some call you brash. They're intimidated by your ability to command a space just by being in it. But you're so confident, you don't care what they think. When we turn the page, we have a picture of Oprah sitting in an armchair with RuPaul sitting on the arm of the chair. Oprah is wearing black slacks and a white blouse and a long black vest. RuPaul is wearing a deep navy and white suit that is made out of this huge graphic print of paisleys. And his head is shaved, and he's got a lime green silk handkerchief in the breast pocket. Come as you are is the heading. Oprah talks with RuPaul, that master of reinvention, show-stopping source of positivity, and a voice for those who refuse to be defined. At roughly 7 feet tall, when you count the stilettos and altitudinous wig, RuPaul is a dazzling, ebullient tornado of fierceness. But what's more impressive is his multi-decade career, during which he's brought drag to the mainstream. His Emmy-winning, eminently quotable show, RuPaul's Drag Race, is scheduled to begin its 10th season this spring. He has released 11 dance pop albums, and he was the first drag queen to land a cosmetics campaign with MAC, M-A-C. He's also preached a gospel of self-love and tolerance that has permeated American culture. Even your mother is probably using the phrase, "You better work," by now. Fascinated by his ability to defy categorization and spark vital conversation about identity, Oprah sat down with the 57-year-old for a much-needed kiki. That's a laugh-filled chat between friends. Here's a quote from RuPaul. "If you have the power to control how people see and interpret you, why not use it?" So let's listen to this interview. Oprah: "I knew you were my kind of human when I first heard you say, 'We're all born naked and the rest is just drag.' We're in these bodysuits and we come up with ideas about who we really are. There's a quote I love. 'We are not human beings having a spiritual experience. We are spiritual beings having a human experience.'" RuPaul: "That's exactly right. As a kid, I thought, is everybody getting that this is all kind of an illusion?" Oprah: "Do you remember the first time you thought that?" RuPaul: "It occurred to me when my parents were in the living room going crazy, beating each other up. I knew that couldn't be right. Then at about 11 years old, I found my tribe in Monty Python's Flying Circus on PBS. I thought, okay, they get it. They're having fun. In 10th grade, my teacher told me, 'RuPaul, don't take life too effing seriously.' I didn't get it then, but I got it later." Oprah: "This month, we're asking the question, 'What defines you?' How would you answer that?" RuPaul: "At this moment, I'm everything and nothing at all. I'm black, I'm white, I'm male, female. To me, seeing all the facets of yourself is the next level of our evolution, understanding who we really are." Oprah: "I love that. So you don't put yourself in any kind of box." RuPaul: "None of them felt like the right fit." Oprah: "Because why do you have to define yourself?" RuPaul: "You don't have to." Oprah: "When did you first understand that doing drag was a meaningful way of expressing yourself?" RuPaul: "You know, I'm an opportunist and a show-off, so I knew show business would be my path. I didn't know how it would work, but I kept an open mind. Then I was in bands in Atlanta, and drag sort of happened to us. It was very different from the kind I do now. It was punk rock with combat boots and smeared lipstick. But I knew I had power in drag because of the reaction I got from people." Oprah. As far as you're concerned, though, drag really applies to all of us. It's whatever we put on after we get out of the shower, right? RuPaul, absolutely, and why not make it work for you? If you have the power to control how people see and interpret you, why not use it? Oprah, your single Supermodel came out in 1992 and was a huge hit. You had that whole era of fame. Then over the last several years, something happened in the zeitgeist that made your way of being and branding and identifying a cultural phenomenon again. You've become a symbol that inspires not just young people, but so many in the midst of their own questioning, their own pain, their own struggles. You must hear from plenty of them. RuPaul, I hear from everyone, not only people who dance to the beat of a different drummer, but people who are sometimes too sensitive for this world because their hearts are so open and they've been beaten down so much. Oprah, is there any particular story or person that stands out? RuPaul, the interesting thing is the stories are all the same. These people aren't recognized by the world, and they're not recognizing themselves. Oprah, I've read that when you started out, your goal was to make people say, RuPaul, I love you. RuPaul, that was the goal of a very young person who didn't know exactly what they really needed. Oprah, because eventually you learned that all the I love yous in the world don't fill whatever void is inside. RuPaul, exactly. Oprah, how did you figure that out? RuPaul, well, after hitting my head against the proverbial wall really hard, I realized I was the only person who could fill that void, which came from wanting to find connection. Oprah, you seem so positive. Are you always in the joy space? RuPaul, no. I work at it every day. I meditate, I go to the gym, and all those inspirational things I say to contestants on the show, those pep talks, I'm actually saying them to myself. I also try to laugh as much as possible. There's a scene in The Witches of Eastwick where all three women start levitating because of laughter. That's the most powerful spell you can cast. Oprah, why do you think drag is resonating so deeply with people at this moment? RuPaul, there's a new breed of young people out there. We do a convention called DragCon, and the kids who come are smart. They've almost got a new belief system that's completely of the 21st century. Our show speaks to that forward-thinking voice. They see the kids on our show overcoming adversities and realize, I can do that. Oprah, what allowed you to move past anybody's expectations and carve out a new path? RuPaul, I think that's who I am naturally, but also my mother was very, very rebellious. She used to say, unless they pay in your bills, pay them no mind. I was a sweet kid, so people would hurt my feelings, but you live long enough, you realize that, baby, that has nothing to do with you. Oprah, that's what Maya Angelou used to say to me. Baby, you're not even in it. When they wrote the story, when they started the rumor, it wasn't even about you. It takes time to learn, though. What was drag? What has drag taught you about how we define ourselves? RuPaul, it shows people that everything's temporary. It's just clothes, paint, powder. Drag is like fame. It doesn't hide you. It reveals who you are. Oprah, yes. If you're a jerk before you get famous, you're just a more intensified jerk afterward. RuPaul, drag can help you understand what you are, how amazing it is to have a human body, and what you can do with it. Oprah, I still marvel at how amazing it is. You talk about being an optimist. Has it been an uphill battle to stay optimistic lately? RuPaul, it is. I'm doing my part, but it's exhausting because I'll assume that we're further along as humans on this planet and then be proved wrong. You think, did I just imagine that we were moving forward? Oprah, you and I both assumed that civilization evolves in a straight line. It does not. You move forward. Then you take a couple steps back to the Dark Ages. You've mentioned mobilizing young people to make social change. What does that look like? RuPaul, We show them through example. I don't have children, but I do know that they learn from their elders in ways parents might not realize, from watching what they do with their garbage to how they react to nudity. It's an inside job, and we all have to pitch in on how we behave. Oprah, what lesson took you the longest to learn? RuPaul, I grew up with a father who was completely shut down, and I thought, okay, you want joy? I got you. For years, I felt my job was to give people like that what they needed, to remind them who they are. But my father couldn't see me because it would have forced him to get in touch with some very painful feelings. That was the hardest lesson to learn. Those people who are shut down, let them be. Let them figure things out on their own. Oprah, what has been the most difficult choice you had to make to fulfill your destiny? RuPaul, well, I don't think my destiny has really happened yet, but the most difficult choice I make every day is to be engaged, choose love, and not succumb to darkness, because it's always in my peripheral vision. Oprah, what do you think your true purpose on earth is? RuPaul, I was going to say something unselfish, but actually I think it starts with me. The first thing is for me to experience this life and enjoy it. And if I enjoy it, I could possibly share that with other people. Oprah, that's one of the best answers I've heard. So many people wonder, what's my higher purpose? Your purpose is to be and to experience life on this planet in its fullness. And if you choose to do something else, that's okay. What we're all actually seeking is the truest expression of ourselves. So when you look in the mirror, what do you see? RuPaul, freckles. You know, I've spent so much time putting on makeup and using my body for a living. So initially, I see it as part of my work. But when I look with my heart, I see that little boy who loved to dance and laugh, my two favorite things to do on this planet. I like the lighter things in life. I tend to go toward the light. Oprah, have you reached the best place for yourself? RuPaul, I think so. Right now, I'm paying attention to everything, but I am focusing on the joy. I'm focusing on the joy. And here's our last contribution in this section on what defines you, and it's entitled Love and Mercy. She spent a lifetime waging war with the memory of her parents. Then Anya Yurchashin uncovered secrets that helped her broker peace. When my mother, Anita, died, I felt relieved. I was 32, and I'd had the same reaction when my father, George, passed away 16 years earlier. Their deaths, my mother's from alcoholism, my father's from a car accident in Ukraine, were ugly, and I welcomed them. My parents were intellectuals whose careers allowed them to travel the world, but that's not how I experienced them. My father was cold and verbally abusive. My mother failed to protect me from his rage, even when she was sober. Tenderness between them was in short supply. They barely seemed to like each other. I saw myself as a casualty of their abundant flaws. My low self-esteem was the result of my father's violent temper, my anxiety the product of my mother's addiction. But while cleaning out her filthy, cramped house, I found something that sent goosebumps across my limbs. A collection of fiery, vulnerable love letters my parents exchanged during their early courtship and marriage, when work separated them. My father had written, "Whenever I leave you, there is an emptiness inside me, a true aching of the heart." In another, my mother rhapsodized, "Our love is wondrous. It has a life almost of its own." I read the words in shock. After that, I made it my mission to understand who they truly were. I crisscrossed America in my car to speak with family members in their kitchens. I met one of my mother's old boyfriends in a Pennsylvania diner and my father's co-workers in plush hotel bars. I wandered the University of Chicago's leafy campus where my parents had met and my mother's best friend from college. The following year, I went to Ukraine to see the country my father had fled as a child and returned to after communism fell in the 90s when I was a teen. I'd seen him as a selfish workaholic, living an ocean away from his family in America. But his friends and coworkers said he'd labored over the decision that helping rebuild his mother country was the fulfillment of a lifelong dream. What he'd done wasn't self-serving. It was ferociously brave and optimistic. Frequently, what I learned broke my heart. My mother had hinted at her difficult childhood, but spared me some of the grimmest details. Her complicated birth required doctors to break her tiny clavicle, which meant her mother couldn't hold or soothe her for several months. Her father abandoned the family soon after and did at least one stint in a mental hospital. Later, she was repeatedly molested by an uncle. How could such a cursed beginning lead to anything other than a tragic ending? What upset me most, though, was something I already knew but hadn't understood. My older brother, Yuri, died from pneumonia just before his first birthday, and they'd waited to tell me until I was 10. While going through their belongings, I found a diary my mother kept while Yuri was hospitalized, where she'd recorded his declining health and her anguish after his death. My arms ached to hold a son who was once mine. I would sell my soul to the devil to hold and cuddle him again. Consumed by sorrow, my parents became increasingly isolated from each other, and that isolation created a river of resentment between them that my birth couldn't bridge. Devastating as it was, this information was a gift, shining a light into the murky corners of my childhood. My father policed my behavior so intensely, not because he was a dictator, but because he was terrified of losing another child. His anger was misplaced grief. And I finally understood that my mother wasn't weak. She'd had to be unimaginably strong to survive the loss of her parents, son, and husband. The soggy drear of her final years wasn't her giving up, but her giving in to a lifetime of pain, finding it too awful to bear. What I'd uncovered led to a revelation. With all this information, I was no longer a victim. I was the product of complicated people who'd done the best they could. Today, I'm proud to be their daughter, a person who's replaced pity with compassion. That compassion opened the door to the emotional prison where I'd kept my parents, and in turn, it freed me. Each month, we have a two-page spread of photograph, and this month in Where Are You Going, we have a picture of a young African-American woman, and she's in a dressing room in a Broadway theater. She's wrapped up in one of those white hotel robes with her back to the mirror and the lights, and she is Haley Kilgore, Broadway phenom. And in the spotlight, she says, "When I was in third grade, my parents went to a conference with my teacher who said, 'Haley often goes to the bathroom and stays in there for long periods of time.' I went to check on her the other day and she was singing. She sings in class too. I don't think she even realizes she's doing it." Instead of disciplining me, the teacher and my parents got me piano lessons, put me in a choir, and found me a voice coach. Singing was how I coped. A year earlier, I had realized I was adopted. I guess it shouldn't have been a surprise, given that my parents are both white. But it hadn't sunk in until a friend said, "You and your dad don't look the same." My parents were very forthcoming, but all I could think about was how someone hadn't wanted me. The feeling was so raw. As I got older, I performed in plays and sang at local basketball games, which led to becoming a resident actor at a theater near where I grew up. At the end of my first year in college, I heard there was going to be a Broadway revival of the musical Once on This Island about a young Haitian girl. The character is adopted and knows there's something she's been put on earth to do. It was a dream part, but I thought there was no way I'd get it. There aren't a lot of 18-year-old leads on Broadway. It's not something that's supposed to ever happen to you. I still can't believe that out of the thousands of talented, beautiful girls who auditioned for this role, they chose me. I know it won't be easy, and some days I'm scared to death, but this is my leap of faith. Once on This Island opened on Broadway in December. As we get to the end of this first installment, let's go to Live Your Best Life and look at a sidebar item here called Creature Comforts. Fur ward thinking. What will the tech geniuses think of next? Smart gadgets for your 21st century pet. And the first one, we have this adorable little fluffy gray kitten pawing at some feathers on the top of this little egg-shaped thing. Shock and paw is what it's called. Cats might be content to spend hours alone, but they still need to play. That's why Tara O'Mara and her husband Jason invented Shrew, a rechargeable toy that rolls and wiggles on its own. When your cat traps Shrew, it shakes and then stops moving to imitate real prey, giving your mighty home-bound hunter the thrill of victory. It's $98 at pdxpetdesign.com. Next, light-footed. In 2010, Joseph Hassan's friend Betty and her dog Comet were almost hit by a car during a nighttime run. The close call inspired Hassan to create a tether that lights up from handle to collar. The battery-powered Nighty Leash uses an LED light that shines through a fiber optic tube to make you and your pooch visible up to a quarter of a mile away. That's $25 at nightyleash.com. And finally, doorbusters. Uninvited felines kept slinking through Nick Hill's cat door and pestering his short hair Flipper. His solution? The Sure Pet Care Microchip Pet Door Connect, which syncs with your cat's or dog's microchip to grant them and only them passage. It also has a curfew mode, so your Maltese can't sneak out past her bedtime. It's $200 at surepetcare.com. And this month's question is, what have you been surprised to discover about yourself? And here are some responses from readers. Sherry Lawrence in Sarasota, Florida says that I really can cook, in spite of the D I got in home economics when I was 13. And Yvonne Cosio of Menifee, California says that I'm content with being single in my mid-40s. After a lengthy marriage followed by multiple relationships, I found true happiness in being on my own. And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Susan Dellinger, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.